accession number 10403, Rule 6.
Mr. Harold Sell, Reel 6. We were talking about the defences you established along the Belgian frontier in the Lille area. You mentioned that the main principle was of defended localities. Was that throughout the three lines of defence, or the lines of defence, this principle was adopted?
The principle is usually adopted throughout. You see, you have forward a patrol line, which gives you always patrol this line in front of your defences, in order that you can be aware of anything that the enemy might be doing. And then you establish these three lines. And of course, it's a principle of war that wherever you go and in whatever circumstances you find yourself, even if you're in reserve, you must be capable of all-round defense. So that wherever you are, you have this defensive principle put into effect.
How did they go about defending a locality? What was the current state-of-the-art defences at that time? How would they go about it?
Well, of course, first of all, you see, when a person comes on, when the unit commanders lay out their defences. Is this all right now?
Yes, that's fine.
They lay out their defences and where they want the guns put and where they want the trenches put and where they want this. And that goes down to right to subordinate commanders. Platoon commanders lay out and they give to get fields of fire and to get observation and to do various things. And then the men dig these trenches in what they call four-hour tasks. And in 4 hours, they dig in to give them sufficient cover in foxholes from which they can fight. Then they link them up so that they can have communication. Then they put out whatever wire or obstacle they have. And then gradually they develop this until it becomes one complete integrated system.
And
it's always such a way that you don't have a straight line. You have it zigzag so that nobody can fire along a trench and get the lot of you.
And this was the pattern of defences you were digging?
Defences. We're digging. And, of course, at that time, the great fear was tanks. So we also constructed right the way across, or were constructing, an anti-tank ditch, which is a monumental thing, almost like the Roman wall, where the tank would have to, we'll say it was an anti-tank ditch, that was being dug.
Was it just a ditch?
It was just a ditch, but you can't have a ditch without covering it by fire or having observation. So wherever the ditch was, it was either covered by fire or by observation where you could bring fire down upon it. Because once the enemy has a chance of reconnoitering a ditch, he can get across it.
So this period then went on from March until the actual German invasion?
Until May, yes.
Yeah, until May. Now, while you were there, did the training develop at all?
Oh, yes. We had to go on field firing ranges. The whole of the units were put through what was known as the bull ring at ETAP, which was field firing and everything else. They were all put through that. And we then got anti-tank guns for the first time. Guns.
Not the rifle.
We got guns. And they were one-pounder Hotchkiss guns supplied by the French government. They were French guns. None of us could read the instructions. It was all technical French. There was no oil in the recuperators. The interpreters couldn't understand the instructions book because they didn't understand the technical language, although they were French. So it was a question of trial and error, and all our anti-tank gunners, within 2 or 3 days, were managing to fire their two-pounders. And that's all they had, two-pounder guns.
Now, this training, how did you assess? You were a territorial yourself.
Yeah.
But Churchill was a regular.
Yes.
How? And I'd like you to talk a bit now about the relationship between you and him in those terms. How did you see, I mean, as a territorial brigade being commanded by a regular? I know you had a conversation with him. If you could just indicate the sort of thoughts that were going through your mind and perhaps his mind at this stage, as you were still in the final throes of training before the German offensive, and the sort of idea you had about the level of efficiency that the brigade had reached?
Well, we had a regular brigade major and a regular CO, Jackie Churchill, and we had regular commanding officers in the battalions. Now, as an extraordinary thing had happened in the 2 months, and that was the regular soldier became to recognize the territorial soldier and himself as one unit. We could talk freely to them. We could voice our fears. We learned how to express our opinions without appearing to countermand instructions, and that was very important. And at the same time, I was able, with Jackie Churchill, to get a sort of rapprochement, as it were, or a feeling that has lasted me all our lives. And that was that we regarded him completely as the master of his trade. And we regarded him as the person who would have the final answer. But we also regarded ourselves as it was our duty to express to him what we thought our own limitations were and how could we overcome them. And therefore, by the time we went into action, and it later developed so in the war, you couldn't tell the difference between one and the other. It was remarkable. But I think it was, of course, that the personality of the man counted such an awful lot.
What kind of a man was he, do you think, his actual personality and his skills?
Very austere. Would not imbibe in drinking or anything of that matter. Was a man who never expressed himself religiously, but had a deep conviction of right and wrong and the welfare of his troops. And I recollect on one, just before Arras, when he was very tired, and I'd been sitting up with him, and he was confirming the orders. And he confirmed the orders, and he said, "Would I look through them to see if there was any possible error before he passed it to the brigade major for being done? Because," he said, "I am tired, and upon what I have written will depend many lives." And I think that concern was expressed on many occasions to me, that he never gave an order without he could try and foresee the end product.
You had a high regard for his professional skills as well.
He was a man who was regarded highly professionally by every soldier. He wasn't a very popular soldier.
Why not?
Popular with with officers of equal rank, because he was not above being forthright and criticizing in open conference items which he considered the superior command might have issued. It might have been a fault, but on the other hand, it was his makeup. He couldn't suppress what he felt was not right.
Was he tactically very astute?
Tactically very good. In fact, had he not moved several of the subunits at the time in the Arras battle and got us out fast and got us round the back of Lille again and up to Armentières so fast, I feel certain the Germans might have got around behind us and cut us off.
What about the other, the brigade major? Do you remember his name?
Yes, Archer Clive.
He was
a guardsman, grenadier guardsman. He was first-class officer and went on to very high things, I believe. So that as a brigade, we were blessed by regular officers had they been specially hand-picked. They could not have been picked better.
We, Were you conscious of the fact, though, that you were civilians and you hadn't had war experience? I mean, you were soldiers, but
yes.
you were territorial, yes. And as such.
Yes. We were civilians in uniform. Mentally, of course, I suppose we were still civilians in uniform. And what went through our minds would only be what we could imagine from what people had told us. We had had no effect. We had never been bombed in our lives before. And it's quite different being on a rifle range to suddenly find there's four machine guns pointed at you and letting off. There's a different feeling. And it takes a bit of getting used to. But you must do that, because unless you've done that, the next stage, that is the further battles, you can never train yourself efficiently and to react efficiently.
Do you think Churchill made allowances for the territorial status of his battalions in what he asked them to do?
Oh, yes, because, you see, he was our brigade commander before the war, in peacetime. And he knew what we were, he knew what was going, and we could talk to him. And he did not take offence if something was given which was thought to be outside our station, because we were genuinely seeking guidance, and he knew it.
Now, do you remember anything else about this early period between March and April? Anything else you were doing in particular?
Training very hard. Training very hard for movements by night. That was the thing. Movement by night. Some great wag decided that because of night, and we had to have our eyes trained, that carrots were good for your eyes. The result was, for about 5 weeks, we had nothing but carrots for a diet. I suppose things happen in all circumstances, but we never thought much of the carrot diet. But otherwise, we went through our drill, we went through ETAP, and we did everything. And, of course, when the balloon blew up, it was quite unexpected. And we just hopped on our vehicles and went straight into Belgium.
So that was the 10th of May, 1940,
yes.
You got the news of the invasion.
Yeah.
What again, a big job for you. Had you got the plans ready, prepared for the move into Belgium, you know, as transport officer? Did you know?
I didn't know the direction. I had no idea. You see, we were all away on exercises on the very day. On the 10th, I think we were at brigade headquarters. We were doing a firing exercise somewhere. And the balloon went up. We rushed straight back to our unit areas. Immediately packed our vehicles, I mean, according to the drill. I mean, everything was just back for battle. And then the orders came from the division, and we were given a route by which we really had to go. When we got the route, I sat down with the BM, and we worked out the march tables. We issued them in accordance with the standard practice.
How long would that take you, from getting the route from division to sorting out a brigade's march tables?
Well, if you give me 10 minutes, I could put it on paper. You see, it isn't a...
So it wasn't a long process?
Not a long progress, you see, but it's only not long if you practice it sufficiently.
So you got the thing. Did it go well?
Oh, yeah, no problem, and we were bombed en route by aircraft on several occasions.
Well, that's your first time under fire?
Yes, it was going up into Belgium. The aircraft came across. There were no Stukas then, but these Junker 88s were bombing us. And that caused a delay, because every time they knocked a hole in the road, we had to go knock a hole in the hedge and go round, you see.
Who'd do that, the actual work?
Well, you see, each truck carries picks and shovels and everything on it, you see. And as soon as that happened, they pulled the truck off the side and the chaps would be out.
And they practiced that?
Oh, yeah, all this sort of thing, practice, yes, you see. They'd be out cutting a hole round and camouflage netting in their trucks and everything like that. All this business went on. This is all part and parcel of the housewifery of soldiering.
Did any bombs come near you, so to speak?
Well, yes, we're getting them all the way along the route. Fortunately, none hit the road, several hit on each side.
How did you feel under fire for the first time? I mean, in yourself?
I don't know how I reacted. The thing was, I couldn't understand why I couldn't see anything. You know, there was a hell of a bang and a cloud of smoke. And unless you were hit, I suppose, there didn't seem to be anything. The ground shook a bit. And your hat lifted a bit, but it didn't seem to have all that effect. I think that random bombing you just took, I think the first thing that our troops were apprehensive of were shelling.
When did you first come under shell fire?
Well, we up near Grammont, up near Brussels, we came under shelling. And the thing about shelling is that once they know where you are, they bracket you. You fire one across, one at the back, and then in the middle, you see, and then bound. And when they drop, until you've been under fire a bit, this is all strange. You don't know where the next one's coming, whereas if you've done it a few times, you know where the next one's coming. And all this was very, very strange. And the amazing thing was, this apprehension was only shown by the soldiers, but by the elder officers who had been in World War I and had been under shell fire, which was far more intense than ever we were getting or likely to get. They didn't even shrug their shoulders. It just went on. It didn't mean a thing. And of course, in due course, I suppose we got into that condition.
So at the start, that was very noticeable.
It was noticeable, yes. It was noticeable that, you see, if a chap had never heard anything other than the firecracker go off, he ducked his head and got under the hedge, you see, when the bag dropped nearby him, you see. Whereas you find a chap who had been through World War I, oh dear me, that was nothing.
Would you try not to duck at the start? Did you manage it? Or?
Well, I don't know. There was one thing that was always instilled in me, and that was, however frightened you are, you mustn't let your troops know you are. You see, this was the thing. And if you felt like ducking down, you still stuck your head up.
So you tried to...
You tried to maintain an equilibrium.
So what do you remember? When did you suffer your first casualties that we were aware of them happening?
Oh, yes. The first casualty was at... It was in a little orchard we were, in a farmhouse, and a dive bomber came and dropped a bomb. I suppose it'd be a very small bomb by today's standards. And we had the office truck, the brigade office truck, under the trees. And this bomb came down and hit the radiator cap and went off. And there was a little orderly there, a chap called Carlton. And he was about 18, just a young lad. And it virtually blown to bits. And that was the first time I'd ever seen anybody killed there. And it was first, I mean, you read about war and you do all this and so on, but until you've really hit the first one, you don't know what it is. And I think that hardened our hearts after that. There was no mercy for the Bosch after that.
So it made a big impact.
Oh, it made a big impact on everybody. They said, right, that's what you want, you'll get it.
And about what date was that? This started, you know, you started...
About 12th, 13th May, that sort of thing, you see. Two or three days after the 10th.
During this period, what were you kept busy doing? I mean, were you just doing the routine work you've already described of...
Yes, I was. We were doing that routine work. I was rushing round to the battalion, seeing how their transport was getting on. I was taking my stand on duty officer in brigade headquarters, you see. It was the usual routine.
How was the system holding up so far? I mean, you still weren't under excessive pressure.
No, the system worked. You see, to us, it was rather like an exercise for which an odd shell came and hit you, you see. And an odd aircraft had a go at you.
Did you have any news on your battle board, or, you know, battle map of what the Germans were doing? Were you aware at all of the nature and direction of their offensive?
Well, we went up behind the up as far as Brussels, And we knew the Germans were coming across that way, and we were busy deploying the brigade to dig in. And in fact, the forward year, the units had begun to do this. And suddenly a sit-rep came through, and that was stuffed onto the battle port.
A sit-rep?
Situation report. Sit-rep came through, and that was immediately plastered on the battle board. And I remember being with Willie Vane, and we saw this thing, in which they said that they, this what they called in those days the swear punkt of the German attack was in the Sudan, and that there were indications that the French were not holding the attack. Either at that time, or the day after, or the day before, I'm not certain, we were virtually overrun by the Belgian army, which had been driven back. And then it came right across the entire, it seemed to me as though the entire Belgian army ran over the top of us.
What effect did that have? I mean, you sat there in your defences.
Yes, we're sitting there. And the whole lot of you, we came over there. Well,
did they disrupt things, or did they affect morale, or what?
It didn't affect morale. And, I mean, you had all the ribald reports by the British soldiery. The morale was very good. I mean, even when the French gave up, they just turned around and says, well, what can you expect from the bloody frogs, you see? It was that reaction. It wasn't as if there was no catastrophe was ever felt at any time.
Did it disrupt your brigade at all when they came through you?
No, because at that time we were static in defensive positions. It was later when all the refugees poured through that the problem on the roads began.
So the Belgians came through.
Yes.
What happened next?
Well, the next thing was when we were up in the Brussels area, around about there, I was astounded. I'd never seen this in my life before. Well, literally hundreds of people. Everything from pushbikes to wheelbarrows, people carrying their grandmothers, their children and everybody else, with the roads absolutely choked, fleeing like mad. No food, nothing. Absolutely nothing. Panic-stricken. And then, of course, the Germans came over and machine-gunned them, which didn't improve the situation. And then we were trying...
What did you think of machine... civilians being machine gunned in that fashion? Was this something you'd expected to see in war? Or?
No. We had the idea that war was war, and the civilians, apart from discomfort and things like that, were not targets.
Did it give rise to any? I mean, you've already mentioned you determined after the death of the orderly. Did it make you more determined, or how did it shape your attitude towards the Germans?
I think the general attitude was that these devils wanted no quarter. Because one thing that British troops won't stand, it is, and he won't stand, is the systematic destruction or hardship to women and children. It just won't do it.
Were you able to do anything for, not yourself personally, but were you able to do anything for the refugees as they passed through?
Well, the only thing that we could do was, I took one group, when we were coming back on our way back into the Arras area, I picked up a group of a man, his wife, and two or three kids, and put them on my truck. And they had bully beef and biscuits or whatever I had, and I gave them the water. I gave them water, and then when I got to an area where I thought that they could, I'd known from the battle board that the Germans hadn't reached, I just marked a map. Michelin map, because we hadn't any army maps then, you know, we had to use French Michelin maps. And I just marked the route on where I thought they could cross the Seine and get across down to south.
So
just gave them the map and stuck them up with food and said, good luck, boys.
All you could do was a personal gesture then. You know, you could help as an individual, but there was nothing that you could do. As a brigade?
Well, you couldn't, because, you see, the volume was so... they were all clamouring for water, they were all clamouring for food, they were all clamouring for lifts. Those that couldn't keep up were left lying on the road.
But just before we get to where you actually put... you were in the defensive positions.
Yes.
And until...
We were not thoroughly dug in. Hmm? We occupied defensive positions, but not got to the stage of having thoroughly dug in before the Germans broke through at the Sedan.
And this was near Grammont, round about the Dodge. Now, on the 18th of May, you began the retreat from the Dodge. That was on account of the news from Sedan, was it?
It wasn't put to us as a retreat. It was put to us, I've got the telegram here, which I kept, in which it read, there are signs of some penetration by the Germans in the south-southwest of the Allied positions, and that the division, because we were motorized, will go to the area of Vimy Ridge, that sort of area, dig in and stabilize it, prevent penetration to the other front. There's no question of Dunkirk, there was no question of anything. You see, so therefore that began the marches and the getting onto Vimy Ridge.
So what was your role? This was a forced march, I think you said.
Yes, a forced march.
What was the difference between, I mean, if you could just describe what the difference was. I mean, obviously it's quicker, but how did you make it quicker? How was it forced?
Well, on a normal march, in order to conserve the efficiency of everybody, you go at a certain pace, you either get proper feeding, they get proper sleep, and they get proper control. On a forced march, you've got to get to the other side, hell or high water. No sleep, lack of food, lack of water, anyhow. Doesn't matter how you get there, you'll get there.
Would you have prepared, so you would have a different criteria in preparing your march plans, or you know, how everybody fitted together? You would be allowing for people going that much faster, for forcing it, or would you not prepare march plans?
Oh yes, you prepare march plans. You prepare march plans.
They'd just be harsher.
You just have to be harsher in your detail. And that would give people at all levels less time to do what they would normally do. And that would be it.
Was it very hard on the men, the
3 days? Oh yes, it was very hard because they'd had to march long distances because the situation had deteriorated, and we didn't know then, but in order to evacuate some of the units and the troops towards Dunkirk, they took away our troop carrying vehicles. So the men were on their feet. The equipment was carried on their trucks, but they had to march. And they were probably marching all day and all night, that sort of thing.
When you say all night, were they billeting overnight for brief periods or stopping overnight for brief periods? Or was it literally 3 days almost on the road?
Well, it was 3 days. If you stopped, everybody fell on the road and went to sleep, and you had to go around and use a boot and get them up. I mean, fatigue is a terrible thing. It overcomes everything.
How did it affect you personally? How did you feel towards the end of the march?
Well, I was rather luckier than most because I'd got a vehicle. But I was deeply conscious of the effect of this upon my brigade commander because I realized that he had been without sleep for a long, long time.
How long would you say?
He must have been about 2 days because he'd done recce all the way up in Grammont and round about there. He'd personally sighted all the defensive positions up there and then suddenly round and get away back again. And he was, I thought, showing signs of fatigue. So what I did was to virtually turn myself into a personal batman, and I always carried a pillow and everything else. And when he stopped and so on, I gave him a drink from a water bottle and shoved a pillow under his head and said I would awake him in half an hour or awake him in 2 hours. You see, I thought that was the best thing.
Why was that? What was so... That was because of his value in making the tactical decisions that could save everyone's...
Well, I always felt that the commander was the man who should have had least fatigue because he must make the final decision.